Okay, let's begin again. Let's begin the second half of lecture two. And we're going to talk about properties of Fourier transforms. So we're going to talk about properties of the Fourier transform. I had a table giving you a bunch of those properties. So what I've listed is some transform of my function. For instance, here I've got a linear combination of two functions, and over here I've got the Fourier transform of that function. I'm going to go through each of these in a bit more detail though, so I'm not going to bother to spend a lot of time on that slide. Let's start with linearity. Linearity just means that if I take a Fourier transform of a linear combination of functions, I get a linear combination of the Fourier transforms. It's a very simple property. It just follows straight from the fact that an integral is a linear operator. So when I take an integral of this linear transform, I can split up the integral in this linear way, and each of these guys is just a Fourier transform in itself. This is a really useful property. I've shown you how we can use it to derive Fourier transforms, but it's also a kind of limit. When we deal with Fourier transforms and when we deal with the systems we're interested in, we're really looking into linear systems or signals which can be represented as a linear combination of other signals. This is great for a vast array of applications, but there are some non-linear applications out there for which Fourier transforms aren't a terribly good approach. So just bear in mind the fact that linearity, while it's very useful, can also be a hindrance in some cases. A time shift. So what's this? A time shift of a function just means I take my function and I shift it along the x-axis or the t-axis by some amount t0. When I do that, think of this as a phase shift. Let's go back and just have a quick picture here. If I take my sine and cosine, you can see that I can get one from the other just by shifting along the x-axis by pi on 2. So that's a phase shift. In the frequency domain, it corresponds to a rotation. And that's exactly what we see in the time shift property. I take a time shift and I get back my original Fourier transform, but there's some rotation. One of these e to the I 2 pi's, it's a complex exponential, but in the complex plane, it just corresponds to a rotation operation. Now, the other thing to notice is that it's frequency dependent. This S term is here. So the amount that we rotate by depends on a particular frequency. And now we know exactly how much we have to rotate by at any particular frequency from this. It's trivially easy to derive this. We just look at the definition of the Fourier transform, do a change of variable so that instead of f of t minus t0 here, I have f of t, end up with a plus t0 up in the exponent. T0 doesn't depend on t, so I can pull that part of the exponential out the front of the integral, and this is just the Fourier transform again. Now, importantly, think about the phase versus the magnitude, or the power spectrum. If I take the magnitude of my new Fourier transform with this rotation, I can see that I can just split the two, the Fourier transform part and the rotation up. Now the magnitude of this rotation, this e to the I pi, is just 1. So I just get the magnitude of my Fourier transform. So the magnitude of the Fourier transform is unchanged. And likewise, the power spectrum is unchanged by this time shift. A phase shift or a time shift, the shifting in time, has no effect on the power spectrum. And that's exactly what we want. We don't want to have a phase shift having any effect on the power at any particular frequency. That would make no sense. Okay, time scaling. So here what we want to do is take our signal and either stretch it out or compress it down to be longer or shorter. But think about what this is doing. Imagine we take a sine wave. So I've got my sine wave like this, and I'm going to compress it and get something like this. What did I just do? Increase the frequency, exactly. So what we would expect to see when we look at the Fourier transform is higher frequencies. So that's exactly what I'm showing you here. I've taken a signal and I've compressed it down in the, this is a discrete Fourier transform in magnitude actually. This is the frequency here too. When I compress this down, I increase the frequency, and you can see the frequency here has been shifted up. And it's also been scaled down a little bit. So that's what we see here. When we take our Fourier transform of a time-scaled version of a function, we get a scaled version of the Fourier transform. There's a magnitude scale and there's a frequency scale in here. You notice that if I take AT, I get S on A, so it goes the other way. So when I compress my signal in the time domain, it gets stretched out in the frequency domain. So here, I've taken a signal and I've compressed it, I've made the frequency higher, that means I have to stretch it out in the frequency domain. And the reverse is obviously true. We derive it by just taking the definition of the Fourier transform and again doing a change of variables. So I want to put this A, instead of having it inside my function F, I want to have it up here. And then it's obvious what the change is. So that's a very useful property. Another useful property is duality. Now, you've already seen this duality property. What it says is that I take the Fourier transform of some sort of Fourier transform, I get back to a function. You notice that I put a big F of T and a little f of S here. What does this mean in effect? Let's go back to, where is it? Slide 13. And you can see exactly what I mean by duality. The Fourier transform in this table, say the Fourier transform of the delta function gives me 1. The Fourier transform of 1 gives me a delta function. The Fourier transform of my rectangular pulse is sinc. The Fourier transform of the sinc function is the rectangular pulse. Now those two cases are kind of trivial, or they're kind of easy, because they're symmetric functions, both of them. And so when I do this, I don't have to worry about the minus sign. Another case would be something like the delta function delta t minus t0, its Fourier transform is either the minus I 2 pi t0 s. If I take the Fourier transform of e to the plus I 2 pi s0 t, that gives me back my delta function. There's a sign change there because this delta function is no longer symmetric in time. So that's all duality means. Again, the proof of the property is just a simple change of variables in the definition of the Fourier transform. And noting the fact that the inverse Fourier transform simply looks almost exactly like the Fourier transform, but there's a plus sign instead of a minus sign. Frequency shift. Now, frequency shift is easy because, let's go back to our time shift. You see a time shift, a shift in the time domain gives us a complex exponential term in the frequency domain. Now, if we apply our duality property, we should realize that a complex exponential in the time domain is just going to give us a shift in the frequency domain. We can also prove it by doing the integration. The integration is not particularly hard either. So this is a nice property. It means that if we multiply any signal by a complex exponential, that just corresponds to shifting that signal in the frequency domain. We use this property a lot. It's used in a whole bunch of signaling systems. The classic one is where we do signal modulation. So imagine this, you have a signal which has frequencies, audio signals. Audio signals, remember, human hearing is going from, say, a few hundred hertz up to a few thousand hertz, say 10,000 hertz. But you think about FM signals, frequency modulated radio signals. There you're talking about megahertz, millions of cycles per second. So I want to take this slow, you know, 1 kilohertz signal, and I want to somehow transmit that at 1 megahertz, say. What I have to do is shift the frequency from a low frequency up to a high frequency. How am I going to do that? Well, all I have to do is take my signal, multiply it by a carrier wave, and that will shift the signal for me. That will shift its frequency. It's a bit simpler if we do it with a cosine function, but modulation with a cosine function means we get two versions of the signal. Why is that? Well, the cosine, remember the cosine corresponds to these two exponentials, and the Fourier transform is linear. So we're going to end up with two terms, one shift up and one shift down. So we can take our signal, imagine you have a signal which has a band, I'll do my text, a band somewhere like this. In the frequency domain it's around here. I multiply that by a cosine and I get one version of it that's shifted up here and I get another version that's shifted down here. So this allows me to do a whole bunch of things. It allows me to send a signal up one way. It also allows demodulation. Imagine I get this signal and I want to somehow translate it down to a signal which is easy for me to hear. I mean, what I want to do with my radio, I want to take a signal, I want to receive that signal, it will be some sort of series of vibrations, oscillations in electrical current, and what I want to do is then put those oscillations through a speaker. But if I just took the radio signal and put it through a speaker, obviously I wouldn't be able to hear it because it would be vibrating a million times a second and my ears don't work that well. So what I have to do is demodulate it. I have to reduce the frequency, and I do that by, again, multiplying by a cosine to give it the appropriate shift so it would take something up here and move it down here. Ah, you say. Well, none of you actually said it, but you could have. What do I do with this guy? If I want to get this one, isn't this going to muck me up? Easy. We'll talk about filters a bit later on. What I do is put it through a filter, a high-pass filter, which looks like this. Lets all of this stuff through, gets rid of all of this. Solves my problem. So this is a little example of a cosine, and what I've done is multiply my signal by another cosine, and you can see the Fourier transform. It's just this spike, and I've got a translated version which has been pushed this way, and I've got a translated version which has been pushed that way, and there's an extra factor of half in here. So that's a good one. Convolution is a good one as well. Now let's see if I can get this to work. Have in theory a little animation here. Okay. Okay, this is probably completely meaningless to you at the moment, so let me go back here and just show you this picture for a second. Convolution is an operation that we do between two functions. It takes two functions and it gives us a function out the other end. So it's kind of an operator on two functions that gives us another function. So people often write a convolution using this star operator, and you might often write f of t star g of t. That's very sloppy notation though, because a convolution takes these two functions and gives us another function. So f star g is a function of t. And the way we work out what that function is by this integration. Please, again, you need to know what convolution is for this course. We will come across several alternate versions of convolutions. There are a couple of different ways we define it in different contexts, but they basically all are the same concept. And you need to understand what a convolution is. You need to have some intuition about it. So, in the notes I have a little web reference to give you some more examples of convolution. Think about what this definition means and so on. I have a little applet to try and give you an idea, a little animation to give you an idea of what a convolution is. So I have my two functions here, the red function and the blue function. So imagine the blue function is f, the red function is g. And what I want to do is for any particular value of t, what I'm doing is multiplying the two functions by each other. Actually, I should just mention something. This red function is not g. See, it's not g of u, it's g of t minus u. It's a time-reversed version of the function. Taking my function, I flipped it around in time. See, I've got a minus u here. And I also have a time shift, t. So you notice that as I go through this animation, my little red function is shifting along by t. This red ball shows you my value of t along this axis. This guy is the function. Remember, it's been flipped in time and shifted along. And you can see the various shifts by value of t. And then what I'm doing is I'm integrating the product. So think about what happens here. I'm taking the product of this function with my red function. Now this is a simple one because I've deliberately chosen simple functions. The rectangular function is just a constant, it's just one along here. So the product of these two is just the red curve or zero. Where this is one, I get the red curve, and out here it's zero. So the value of the integral is just going to be the area in here, the area under this curve. And that, when I take this area, I take that integral, that gives me this value for that particular value of t. So you can see that as the function shifts along, the area in here grows and this integral grows until I get to that point where suddenly I go past here and suddenly the area under here is getting smaller and smaller again, and you can see my integral, my convolution will decrease. Now here's interesting. The two functions, now effectively they don't overlap anymore, or the zeros of the two overlap. They don't overlap, so if I multiply these two functions together, I just get zero. If I integrate zero, I get zero. So where the two don't overlap at all, the convolution gives me zero. Why is convolution important? Well, there are a whole lot of interesting operations. Linear systems can be described as convolutions. Filtering operations can be described as convolutions. There are a whole lot of things that we can do with convolutions that are really useful to us. One of the really powerful things about the Fourier transform, one of the really cool things is if I take a Fourier transform of a convolution, I get a product. Fourier transform of the convolution of F1 and F2 gives me the product of their respective Fourier transforms. This is really cool. Now, go back to our definition of convolution. How many people like doing integration? Put your hand up. Put your hand up if you love doing integration. I'm not seeing any hands, not a single hand. I don't love doing integration. I think doing integration is a pain, particularly if you have to do it numerically. I mean, there are some integrals which we can't work out analytically. We have to do them numerically. That could be a huge pain for us. Multiplication is much easier. So by doing this Fourier transform, we now have a much easier problem. This is directly analogous to, remember I talked in the first lecture about taking logs. Instead of, when we use logs so that we don't have to do products, we take the log of a product and we get a sum. It's easier for us to do numerically. Again, same thing here. We take the Fourier transform and suddenly we have a product. Much, much easier for us to deal with products than it is for us to deal with convolutions. So, This is a really, really powerful property of the Fourier transform. This is one of the major reasons, major reasons, why the Fourier transform is useful to us. Okay, proof. Proof is not hard. It does involve a couple of little technical things which I'm not going to go into. For instance, here, you'll notice that I've changed the order of integration of a double integral. I'm not really allowed to do that for any possible set of functions, because you notice my integrals are from minus infinity to infinity. I actually have to be a little bit careful about the technicalities there, but for most of the real signals that you will ever have to deal with, it doesn't matter. It will work. Or there is some trick, such as multiplying by a Gaussian, which allows it to work. So I'm being a little bit loose in some of the math here. I'm not giving you all of the technical conditions that have to be satisfied. But intuitively, for most of the sorts of things that you will ever deal with in terms of real signals, it's not a problem. How do we do this? Well, simply, we take our definition of the Fourier transform. This is my definition of the Fourier transform here. Notice this is my convolution integral with respect to u. This is my Fourier integral with respect to t. I change the order of integration. And when I do that, f of u doesn't depend on t. It's a constant with respect to t. So I can pull it out the front of this first integral. Now, this first integral with respect to t, you notice, is just a time-shifted, flipped version of g. So it's a Fourier transform of a time-shifted, flipped version of g. This just gives me my Fourier transform out here. Of g, using the properties that I've shown you earlier, and assuming my function g is real in this particular case. If the function g wasn't real, if it was a complex function, then I'd have to do a little bit more work here. Now, g of s no longer depends on u, so I can pull g of s out the front of this integral, and I get a Fourier transform of f. So I get my product down the bottom. This is a very general technique of proving convolutions. We will later on in this course see the concept of a discrete convolution, and you can do a very similar thing with summations in the discrete case to do the discrete proof. You should know this proof. You should be intimately familiar with convolutions. You should be able to do them in your sleep. It's important for this course. An example. What do we get if we convolve two rectangular pulses? Well, it's pretty easy to do the math, because rectangular pulses is a very simple definition. Remember, it's just a rectangular function like this, defined in terms of two step functions. This is my convolution integral. I'm going to break it into bits. What are the various bits corresponding to? Well, let me draw you a quick picture. I'm going to have two bits here. Firstly, this will be R of, what did I put in here? S. So this is going to be S out here. And then I'm going to have another function. I'm going to multiply it by, which is going to be my R of t minus s. Now, there's a few cases here. One would be like this. Notice that this distance here is t. This is the how far I've shifted my function. When t is less than minus 1, the two functions don't overlap at all. And so in that case, I get 0. When I shift out over here, I also get a case where they don't overlap. That gives me my 0 down here. Then I get cases where they overlap partly. I've broken that into two different cases as well. But typical sort of thing might be like this, where the two overlap like that. Now you can see that as this is my t here, as t goes to zero, well, in this particular case, what is it when the function is here? T is equal to 1, the two just failed to overlap, so when t is equal to minus 1 out here, it's going to be 0. When as these push together this way, it's going to get bigger and bigger until they overlap completely. When I multiply two rectangles by themselves, when they overlap, the area under it's just going to be 1, so it's going to go up to 1 over here, and then it's going to start to decrease as my function goes out here, and the area that I'm integrating decreases. And as it turns out, I get linear increase and linear decrease. So I get a function that looks like this. We can write that in terms of integrals. This is just one particular case when we have minus 1 less than t less than 0. I write the integral out like this. I don't have to do it over the range minus infinity to infinity because I know that these things only overlap over this range here. In the area where they overlap, r of s and r of t are both 1, so the product is 1. So when I integrate this thing, it's just integrating a constant over this range. Integrating a constant gives me t for that range. When I work out the value, it just gives me 1 plus t. Remember, t is negative here, though. T is a negative number, so this goes from 0 to 1. Likewise, when t is between 0 and 1, I get 1 minus t. So the integral, the convolution of these two rectangular pulses gives me a triangular function, a triangular pulse like this red line here. The blue curve is the rectangular pulse. The red line is its convolution, this triangular pulse. You notice a couple of things about it. Firstly, it's a bit wider than the rectangular pulse. Secondly, in some sense it's a bit smoother than the rectangular pulse. The rectangular pulse has these big discontinuities at the edges. The triangular pulse is a continuous function, but it has discontinuities in its first derivative. So it's a bit smoother. And this is a general thing. As I keep convolving rectangles with themselves, I get smoother and smoother functions. When I look at the Fourier transform, one of the nice things here, once I know what this triangle looks like, I don't have to do any work to work out its Fourier transform. I know the Fourier transform of a rectangular pulse. It's just the sinc function. So to get the Fourier transform of the triangular pulse, I just take the Fourier transform of R times the Fourier transform of R, which is sinc times sinc, it's just sinc squared. I get a sinc squared function. So this is a picture over here of the sinc function, or its absolute value actually, and the sinc squared function. We'll talk a bit more about these sort of functions in the context of windowing functions later on in the course. Generally speaking, we can continue this on. So we can keep convolving a rectangular pulse with itself. Two convolutions. You start getting something that looks like this. It's actually quadratic curves joined together. It's a piecewise quadratic function. It's not actually a smooth function because there are discontinuities in the second derivative of this function. But it's starting to look smoother. And you notice that its Fourier transform is starting to look more, these bulges, these side lobes down here are starting to vanish. What's happening here? Well, we know that it's going to tend towards sinc to the power of n. Actually, as we take these convolutions in the limit, we end up with a Gaussian function. Why is this? Well, this is related to a thing called the central limit theorem, which I'm not going to spend any time on in this course. But it's one of those very powerful theorems in the context of statistics. And it also relates to this use of convolution. We're not going to talk about it anymore in this particular course, but it is very useful to know that this limiting convolution of rectangular pulses gives us a Gaussian. Then, what does the Fourier transform of a Gaussian look like? It's a Gaussian. Fourier transform of a Gaussian is a Gaussian. So we know that this guy, this red curve, the limiting version of our Fourier transform of the convolution of these R's, is going to tend towards a Gaussian as well. So we know the limit of sinc to the n now. We know it's a Gaussian, which is interesting. So this gives us a bunch of powerful techniques for dealing with various Fourier transforms, working out what Fourier transforms are and so on. But it's going to be more useful than that for us later in the course. Another example. Now, I'm just going to tell you this for the moment. If I have a piecewise linear function, what does that mean? A piecewise linear function means that each bit, each piece of it is a linear function, but there are corners. So it's not a straight linear function, it's not just a line, it's a bunch of lines that have been sewn together in some way. I can get that by taking a convolution of a series of deltas with a triangle, a triangular pulse. This is a very useful thing. This is a way of interpolating a function. Interpolation means reconstructing the bits of the function I don't know about. So imagine someone told you these numbers, and they told you the function was piecewise linear. One way of fixing that would be just draw a line between those points. Okay, that's easy for you to do on paper. Someone draws this on paper, you draw lines between it. But what if you want to do it, write a computer program that's going to tell you those interpolated values? There are a couple of different ways you could do it. One of them is you just implement a convolution with a triangular pulse. And that will tell you all the values of this function in the gaps that you don't know about to start with. So this is a very useful thing. This is the sort of thing that we use when we're doing digital to analog conversion. We have a digital signal like this, and we want to get out an analog signal on the other end. Obviously, D to A converters tend to be a bit cleverer than this, because we don't necessarily want to get a piecewise linear function all the time. But this is a nice thing to know about. I'll let you guys prove this in your spare time. It's not that hard to show. So how does this help you? Why is this important? Well, think about the Fourier transform of this function. Say I want to work out the Fourier transform of this piecewise linear function. This is one way of writing that function. This is my sum of delta functions. Fi is just the height of each of those deltas, and Ti is its displacement. I'm going to convolve that with two rectangles. Each one of the convolution of the two together gives me my triangular pulse. So this is going to be my function, piecewise linear function. I just told you how to get it. You take your deltas, you convolve them with a triangular pulse. Now, I know how to do convolution in the frequency domain. When I do in my transform, it's just a product. I know how to do this guy's Fourier transform. I use the linearity of the Fourier transform, and I use the fact that I know the Fourier transform of a delta. The Fourier transform of a delta gives me this complex exponential term. The linearity means that I just keep this same form, the sum over all I, Fi times these terms. And the convolution means that I multiply by sinc squared. So now, I know the Fourier transform of any piecewise linear function, at least as long as I have this even sampling the way I did with this particular example. So this is a really neat thing. This gives us a way of working out Fourier transforms for a wide class of functions, practical functions that we might have to deal with, and it's very simple, very concise. So there are a whole bunch of things this convolution property does for you. We will see a whole bunch of them, more of them later on in the course. Okay, a few more slides to get through. I'm not going to go through these in quite as much detail. These are properties that we use from time to time, typically to calculate new Fourier transforms, for instance. The Fourier transform of the derivative, we just take the Fourier transform of the function itself and multiply by i2 pi s to the power of n, where we take the nth derivative. And this is just a quick derivation of that property. Again, not trying to get all the bells and whistles in terms of the technical conditions that we need to have for these things to hold, but to give you an idea of why it's true. Similar result holds with respect to the inverse Fourier transform. You should expect this by now because of the duality property of the Fourier transform. Whenever we have a property of a function in terms of these things, we should also see that same property mirrored in the frequency domain by duality. There's a similar property as well that I haven't gone into detail with in terms of integration. You know, there's a dual between differentiation and integration. We get the same sort of property out the other end. There are a couple of useful rules that we have to have for Fourier transforms. Firstly, if we have an even function, we get an even transform. That's easy enough to prove. We just look at the Fourier transform of minus s. That means we put a minus s up in this exponent, but I can do a change of variables, so I end up with, I put the minus in front of the t here, then I do a change of variables so that I get t here, and I get minus t in my function. Now you can see, if this was an even function, that would mean that f of minus t is equal to f of t, so this would just be f of s then, so I would get f of minus s is equal to f of s. I would get an even transform. If my function is even, I get an even transform. Similarly, if I have an odd function, I get an odd transform. When I deal with even functions, when I deal with real functions, it's a little bit more general again. When I have a real even function, I get a real even transform. So that means if I take the complex conjugate of it, I'm going to get the same function out the other end. It's a real function, so the complex conjugate, again, I'm doing exactly the same sort of proof. I'm just taking the minuses, doing a change of variable to get me minus t down here. When I take the complex conjugate of a real function, I just get the function again. It's even, so the minus t means I get the function again. So this just gives me f of s. So I get f star of s gives me f of s. And likewise, when I put a minus s in there. Real odd functions give me imaginary odd transforms. So the two examples of this are sine and cosine. Cosine is an even function. It's real, it's even. So when I take the Fourier transform of the cosine, I get a real even transform. Let's go back and have a look way back here at my examples. The Fourier transform of my cosine, the red curve, gives me these two spikes. You can see that it's even. It's symmetric around this axis. It's also real. It only has real values. There's no imaginary component. When I look at sine, sine is an odd function. It's also real though. So I get, when I take the transform of a sine function, I get an imaginary function and it's odd. When I flip it over, I get a change in sine. So these are some useful properties that we'll use from time to time. Here's a picture. This is actually of a discrete signal. You notice that when we do discrete signals, we end up with some noise. I'll tell you where that noise comes from. It's quantization noise. I'll tell you where quantization comes from. Quantization noise comes from in the next lecture. But you can see that we have these two big spikes corresponding to the particular frequencies we're interested in from our cosine. Existence of Fourier transforms. Well, remember, this Fourier transform is an integral. Integrals don't automatically exist. You know, if you try and integrate one from minus infinity to infinity, the integral won't exist. It doesn't make sense to talk about that integral. Or the value of the integral could be infinite. These are both things that can cause us some problems. So how do we deal with that? Well, as it turns out, there are a bunch of different conditions we could apply to our function, and if the function satisfies these conditions, it guarantees the Fourier transform will exist. The sorts of things you typically see are things like there's a finite number of discontinuities in F. F has bounded variation. The modulus, the integral over the modulus of F gives us a real, the integral exists. So these are the sort of conditions that people typically apply when they're deriving Fourier transforms. But there are cases which don't satisfy these conditions, and we can still talk about Fourier transforms. Classic examples of this are a DC signal. We can talk about the Fourier transform of a DC signal, or an infinite sine wave, a sine wave that goes from minus infinity to infinity. That simplistic definition of the Fourier transform won't be defined in this particular case. Likewise, a delta function, delta is not really a function, it's a functional. So it doesn't satisfy these conditions. So there are a bunch of cases we have to deal with which are simple sort of cases with bounded variational or the equivalent. So I could go away and I could spend a lecture telling you the sorts of conditions that you need to satisfy for your Fourier transform to be well defined, and how we define it in the pathological cases, and how we deal with all of those sort of issues. I'm not going to do that. Why am I going to do that? Well, this is a course that's oriented towards signal processing. It's not a math course as such. What we want to do is look at applications of Fourier transforms. In the applications we're going to look at, nearly all of the signals that we care about, all of the signals we're ever going to deal with, they're going to be nice, in some sort of quote marks, nice. Nice enough so that we can take a Fourier transform of it. So this is not to say that you shouldn't be careful about this mathematically when you're calculating Fourier transforms or proving properties of Fourier transforms. In reality, you should be very careful about these sort of conditions. But for practical purposes, we don't generally have to worry too much about the existence of our Fourier transforms. There's usually some way of getting a Fourier transform. For instance, I mentioned this idea of multiplying by a Gaussian to make sure the tails of the function disappear quickly enough. Invertibility is very important. The Fourier transform, remember I define a Fourier transform, I define its inverse. When we have an inverse, we want this property to hold. When we take the inverse Fourier transform or the Fourier transform of a function, we'd like to get back to the original function. That thing looks like this. I think I'm going to leave it as an exercise for the master students, probably only, to go away and prove that this thing holds for some reasonable class of functions. Where f is discontinuous, you can't quite do this. Imagine you have a discontinuity in your function. What we normally want to get is some sort of analog of the inversion property holding. This is what we mean by invertible, though. And one of the nice things about the Fourier transform is it is invertible. As I mentioned, it's a trigonometric basis, a basis of sines and cosines, a bit more complicated than our Fourier series basis. Now we're including all of the sines and cosines. Remember the Fourier series, we only had to look at a countable set of them, where we had integer multiples of the frequency we're interested in, or the period we're interested in. Here we can't assume fixed periodicity, so we include all of the sines and cosines. We do that by having these complex exponentials which are indexed by a continuous variable, in our case f. So we end up with a continuous spectrum. So that's just a final point to go on with. So I just thought I'd finish off this lecture with a couple of observations to lead into our next lecture. Firstly, so far what I've been talking about is math. I'm talking about Fourier transforms of functions. But in reality, we care about Fourier transforms of signals. We want to take something, some real signal, and we want to do a Fourier transform of it. We want to see its frequency component. Now, there's a bunch of different ways of tackling this. The analog way, the dealing with these continuous functions, is kind of an analog thing. We'll talk about the discrete case next lecture. But we have these analog functions. How can we get a grip on them? We can't build a device that's going to take this signal, write it as a function, and then do this integral for us. That doesn't make sense. We can do that where we're told the signal looks like a cosine or a delta function, but we can't do that with an analog device. Think of an analog device, some sort of device with mechanical bits. like microphones and electronic bits like electrical circuits, that's not going to do an integral for us. So we need to have some device which will work out how we can get our signal out. You notice that in reality nothing is continuous, you know, air is made up of atoms, but there are so many of them that we treat them as being continuous. Later on I'll talk about discrete signals again. So how do we do this where we can't measure the, we can't do this integral? Well, the standard sort of techniques, the analog ones people used to use, are things like a spectrum analyzer. So think of a spectrum analyzer as a band of filters, a series of filters. So what you do is you take your signal and put it through a bunch of filters, like this. Take my signal. Here I've got some sort of signal. I'm going to take it, I'm going to put it through a bunch of filters. And each one of these filters selects out a particular band of the spectrum. So what it does is it takes this spectrum and it divides it into blocks. So this bit might give me this block, and this bit might give me this block, and this might give me this block. And this filter, obviously a real filter, I can't have an infinite number of these filters. So each one of them is going to give me a block of this spectrum. And if this is an analog device, these are analog filters, they're analog electrical components and so on. And I have to build each one of these, it's a circuit. So I can't have a really large number of them either. Also, when I build something like this, it's pretty inflexible. Once I built it, I built it. You know, soldering capacitors and things onto a circuit board. So this sort of thing is pretty inflexible. But you can do a lot with it. You can pull out each of these frequencies and you can see some representation of your signal as a spectrum. So I don't know how many of you have stereos out there. A lot of stereos have this little display on it with these little lights with a frequency along the x-axis. It's basically doing this. It's putting your sound through a frequency analyzer like this, a spectrum analyzer, and giving you a picture of the various spectral components of your signal. There are other ways we can do this. The classic sort of techniques for, say, light is we use what we call a massively parallel analog device. Typically, we might call this a prism. So this is a picture of Dark Side of the Moon, the cover of the album, or one of the covers of the album, the original one, I think. Just showing you a kind of crude picture of a prism. But there's another sort of device we can use, which is a diffraction grating, and a classic example of this is something like a CD, where we have a lot of lines close together. And you can see it splits up the colors. You can see various colors coming off at different angles from a CD when you look at it. So this is splitting up the different frequencies so that we can analyze them separately. The other classic device people use is a Fabry-Perot interferometer. These are physical devices that split up the frequency components and then we can analyze them separately. Another example is one of the devices that Kelvin built, which was for analyzing tides. Trying to derive the frequency content or the periodicities in tides. So we built this massive grate. This is like big. This is like room-sized device. And each bit of this device is effectively a filter bank to filter out a particular frequency. And he had four frequency components and a DC component in his device to pull out of this signal. So this is what he was trying to do here. Again, though, you can see that this tidal gauge illustrates a real point. These analog devices are hard to build. They have limited resolution. You have to build one filter for each of these guys. So you have a limit to the resolution you can get. Digital devices are often a lot cheaper and a lot better and a lot easier to build, today particularly. So that's what we're going to talk about in the next lecture, how you start to deal with all of this stuff, Fourier transforms and so on, in the digital domain, where a lot of signal processing is done these days.